Good evening, everybody. If I could have your attention. I'd like to speak tonight about some Second Temple history parallels to situation Israel today, but considering that there's so much going on and all of our concern about it, I thought it would be a nice idea to begin the night with reciting three Mizmoret Tehillim together, followed by a prayer for the IDF soldiers. So we can recite together the following. Shir ha-ma'alot el Adonai besaratali karati vaya'aneni Adonai hasila nafshi misifat sheket milashon rimiya Ma yiten lecha u'ma yosif lach lashon rimiya Chise gibor shenunim im gachale detamim Oyali kigalti meshech shachanti imahole kedar Tabat shachena lah nafshi im sone shalom Ani shalom v'chi adaber hema v'milchama. I'll read the translation. I'll update the translation a bit. A song of ascents. In my distress I called to God and he answered me. O God, save me from treacherous lips, from a deceitful tongue of the press that sometimes puts things out of context. What can you profit? What can you gain, O deceitful tongue? A warrior's sharp arrows with hot coals of broomwood. Woe is me that I live with Hezbollah, that I dwell among the clans of Hamas. Too long have I dwelt with those who hate peace. I am all peace, but when I speak, they are for war. Shir lama'alot. Esa enai leharim, me'ayin yavo ezri. Ezri meim Adonai, oseh shamayim va'aretz. Al yiten v'mot v'aglecha, al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan, shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai selecha, al yad yiminecha. Yomam ha-shemesh lo yakeka, v'yareach b'layla. Adonai yishmolcha mikol ra, yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor setecha u'boecha, me'ata v'ad olam. A song for ascents. I turn my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help comes from God, maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot give way. Your guardian will not slumber. See, the garden of Israel neither sleeps nor slumbers. The Lord is your guardian. God is your protection at your right hand. By day the sun will not strike you, nor the moon by night. God will guard you from all harm. He will guard your life. God will guard you, your going and coming, now and forever. Setecha boecha are key words for going and coming in war. I'd like to add one joyous psalm as well, commemorating the 228 olim that came with Nefesh B'Nefesh yesterday on the flight. Not one of them canceled. Over 100 children came on this flight, and you see them yesterday smiling, excited, and no matter what's going on, totally dedicated to coming and showing their dedication to Israel. So let's read the very next Mizmor, 122. Shir ha-ma'alot David. Samachti be'omerim li bet Adonai nelet. עומדות היו רגלנו בשערייך ירושלים, ירושלים הבנויה כעיר שחוברה לה יחדיו, ששם עלו שבטים שבחייה, עדות לישראל להודות לשם אדוני, כי שמה ישבו כיסות למשפט, כיסות לבית אביו. שאלו שלום ירושלים, ישליו אוהבייך, יהי שלום בחילך, שלווה בארמנותייך. למען אחי ורעי, אדברה נא שלום בך. למען בית אדוני אלוהינו, אבקשה טוב לך. A song of ascents of David. I rejoiced when they said to me, we are going to the house of God. Our feet stood inside your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem built up, a city knit together, to which tribes would make pilgrimage, the tribes of God, as we enjoyed upon Israel, to praise the name of God. There the thrones of judgment stood, thrones of the house of David. Pray for the well-being of Jerusalem. May those who love you be at peace. May there be well-being in your ramparts, peace in your citadels. For the sake of my kin and friends, I pray for your well-being. For the sake of the house of the Lord of our God, I seek your good. מי שברך אבותינו אברהם, יצחק ויעקב, הוא יברך את חיילי צבא הגנה לישראל העומדים על משמר ארצנו וערי אלוהינו, מגבול הלבנון, במדבר מצרים, מנעם הגדול, עד לבוא הערבה, ביבשה, באוויר ובים. ייתן אדוני את אויבינו הקמים עלינו, נגפים לפניהם. הקדוש ברוך הוא ישמור ויציר את חיילינו מכל צרה וסוכה, מכל נגע ומחלה, וישלח ברכה והצלחה בכל מעשי ידיהם. ידבר שונאינו תחתיהם, ויעצרם בחצר ישועה ובעצרת ניצחון. ויקוים בהם הכתוב, כי אדוני אלוהיכם ההולך עמכם, ולחם לכם עם אויביכם, להושיע אתכם, ונאמר אמן. Okay, so now we'll begin the lecture, and I was just thinking that, you know, as whatever challenges we're going through, I feel comforted to know that we have a 3,000-year history, and so whatever's going on today, there is a precedent, and we can learn from our history about how to confront some of the challenges of today. So I want to talk about three different subjects today, three themes that are all related. First one about war and ethics, second about mourning and redemption, and the third about baseless hatred and rabbinic leadership. So we have a lot to do. So let's get started. This last week's parasha that we just read, we read a story, talked to Moshe about it just earlier, he asked me about it, that on the face of it is somewhat troubling. It's a very interesting story because it's one where Moses and the generals of his army are actually discussing a question of Jewish ethics about killing of civilians. And so what could be more relevant? The story is that God commands Moses to go and take revenge against the Midianites. And so the generals go, and they have this war, and they kill all of the soldiers, and they bring back the women and the children and the animals. And they come back thinking that they're going to be heroes, they won the war. But Moses became angry with the commanders of the army, the officers of thousands and the officers of hundreds who had come back from the military campaign. Moses said to them, "You have spared every female, yet they are the very ones who at the bidding of Bilam induced the Israelites to trespass against God in the matter of Peor, so that God's community was struck by the plague." So Moses gets angry, he says, "You should have killed the women also." Now, number one, recognize that this would be out of the ordinary. Normally, women would not be killed. It's only in this particular situation, because they were the cause of the sin in the first place, that they were killed. But still, this is difficult to swallow, right? That he would just get angry and say, "You should have killed the women as well." Spare the young ones, right, who did not know man. And so, it's so interesting because, well, number one, in the text, it never says that God had told Moses to tell them that. So we're not sure if this is with God's backing or Moses' own reaction. It also never says if the generals went and followed up or ignored his command, right? So it looks like here, just like now, there's so much discussion about what's the right thing to do within the Israeli cabinet, within the general Jewish community, within the larger political community, about what the right thing to do is, because these are very subtle questions. And I want to share with you what the Midrash says about this, because the Midrash really turns it around. And it says, because Moses, our teacher, became angry, he came to error. Rabbi Elazar stated that in three instances Moses came to anger, and because he was angry and he decided something in anger, he made a mistake. With Elazar and Itamar, it says he got angry and he accused them, "Why didn't you eat of the chatat?" This is when Aaron's sons died, and he didn't feel like eating from the joyous sacrifice on that day. Moses got angry and said, "You should have eaten." But the Midrash says it was a mistake, that because he was in mourning, he shouldn't have had to eat from the sacrifice. Another time when he says, "Listen, you rebels," they got angry, and he calls them rebels and hits the rock. Again, because he got angry, he made a mistake. And here also, even though it doesn't say explicitly that he said the wrong thing, he got angry at the commanders. What does it then state? Elazar the priest spoke to the soldiery. In other words, the next paragraph, God gives his instruction to Eleazar, not to Moses. Which sounds like, Moses, you have to take a time out. Right? You're too angry. You need to calm down. You're showing that you're not capable at this moment of leadership that's required. So you see how sensitive the rabbis of the Midrash are to the ethics of war that come up here. And so we have in our tradition really a lot of discussion about ethics of war. I think it's unfortunate that today a lot of the discussion in the community is going on Facebook and Instagram. Some of you are reading some of the things that are going on there. And it's impossible in the 140 characters to really develop any insightful thought. And instead people are forwarding all kinds of vitriolic statements and all kinds of nonsense. But I think we can look back at our tradition and say, how does the Torah deal with it? How did the rabbis deal with these very difficult questions themselves? If you look at the book of Deuteronomy, where it has the laws about going to war, it instructs us you always have to sue for peace first. It's actually almost impossible to ever make a surprise war, right? Because you have to ask about peace first. People are exempt. People who built a new house, who got married, have a new vineyard, are exempt from going to war. I think Torah is telling us that the value of life is triumphant, and we don't glorify war at all. And the Torah further states that if you're in a siege, you have to make sure not to destroy any fruit trees. And it says, because are the fruit trees human that they can withdraw during the siege, right? Why are they involved? Why involving nature? Why involving the fruit trees? After all, someone's going to be living, at some point the war will be over, and someone will be living here, and they're going to need to eat. So you have to respect the trees that are there. So you see, I think, a lot of sensitivity around this. Since I spoke to you last week, New York Times twice had a picture of Palestinian children that were killed on the front page. Certainly very, very disturbing. And both times I thought of this story from the Book of Kings. This is a war by the king of Moab was fighting against the joint forces of the Israelites, Judah, the north and the south, and Edom. And during the war, these three kings, the Israelite kings, were winning the Moabites. And then, in the middle of the war, when Moab, the king of Moab, saw he was losing, he resorted to his atomic weapon, to child sacrifice. When the king of Moab saw that the battle had gone against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through the king of Edom, but they failed. Then he took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him as king, and offered him as a sacrifice on the city wall. Their fury against God was great. They withdrew and returned to their own land. So surprising, number one, that he would sacrifice his son to his God. And it's even more surprising that it worked. Right? What does that mean? How did it work? So I don't know if it actually worked, or if doing this, the Moabite army got so excited and felt confident, or on the other side, perhaps the Israelite and Edomite armies saw this and said, maybe that will be effective. Perhaps they believed it as well, and they got scared and ran away. But in any case, sacrificing their child worked to end the war. So obviously this is somewhat different. They're sacrificing their child to the god of Chemosh, and the Palestinians are forcing us in a way to sacrifice their children, perhaps for the benefit of media that presents this without the context. I think we have to feel, and we do feel, very sensitive to every time we see something like this. I think of the famous words of Golda Meir whenever this happens. It says, we can forgive the Arabs for killing our children, which is not an easy thing to do. But even more, we cannot forgive them for forcing us to kill their children. We will only have peace with the Arabs when they love their children more than they hate us. It's difficult to know the dynamics that are going on in Palestinian society, but certainly the leaders of Hamas are not building bomb shelters, not protecting their citizens, putting their own citizens in harm's way. And so we can and should blame it mostly on them, but still, I think it's a part of the tragedy is that we're forced into a kind of situation where in order to protect ourselves, we have to engage in these very, very difficult ethical situations. I think ultimately, you know, the Jews experienced a lot of war. The First Temple period, Second Temple period, during the Hasmonean period is actually the only time during Second Temple when we had an independent state. About 100 years, from 164 till 63 BCE. And in a way, that time is the most parallel to the modern state of Israel, because we had a powerful army, we expanded, we took over other peoples as well. It's always said that the Jews don't forcibly proselytize, which is true, mostly. But one exception is during the times of the Hashmonaim, when we forcibly proselytized the Edomites. And we see what happened because of that. Herod the Great, right, who we thank him for the tourism industry, as I said last time, but he was also a vicious murderer and not a friend of his own people, of the Jews. And so we see, you know, everything has a reaction. And I think the rabbis are reflecting on their own time, on their own wars, the revolts against the Romans, are thinking about war. And whereas so many cultures, ancient cultures, Roman culture especially, glorified war, the highest thing is to be successful in the army, and they would go out, and that was part of the economy of the Roman Empire, to continue to take over more and more lands. And the rabbis talk about their idea of, should war be glorified? And the way they put it, within a halakha, in the Mishnah and Shabbat, so beautiful. Let's read this Mishnah. It says, a man should not go out with a sword, bow, shield, club, or spear. You're not allowed to carry things outside on Shabbat. Right? You can't carry your laptop, you can't carry your book or anything else. But you're allowed to wear clothing, right? Because you're wearing it, you're not carrying it. So the question is, if you're wearing the sword or your bow or holding a shield, is that considered part of your clothing and therefore you're allowed to go out? Or is it carrying something external and therefore you'd not be allowed to go out? So the opening says you're not to go out, and if you did, your lie is liable of sin offering. Rabbi Eliezer says they are ornaments for him. So he says, no, they're allowed. This is ornament. Even if you're not going to war, you walk around with your sword, right, and your shield and your helmet, and you look all regal, noble. But the sages say, no, that's only minority opinion. They are nothing but ugly, since it is said, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Right? And in fact, our goal is to have peace. And we have to go, if we have to go to war, we do, but it's only reluctantly. And these items, sword, shield, these are ugly things, and if you're carrying them, it's carrying something. You won't wear them. They're not a sign of nobility at all. And I think this is beautiful how the rabbis infuse so much of their worldview into a technicality of halakha. That's the language they speak. That's how they relay what their philosophy is. Okay. Right, I think probably one of the biggest challenges in Israel today are these questions of ethics, of war. And there's a little more to say about this, but as a generality, we'll leave it at that. And I want to go on to the second subject, which is mourning. We're in a time of mourning right now during the 3 weeks. But we also feel a sense of redemption, that things are really so much amazingly better than they had been for the past 2,000 years. And how do we weigh these two poles? When is it time to celebrate? When is it time to feel like to feel connected with the past of things that happened? So I want to bring a parallel from the beginning of the State of Israel. And I think we're still in the beginning of the State of Israel. We're only 70 years into it, not even. So it's still a very young country. So I want to bring a parallel to the beginning of the modern State of Israel, to the beginning of the Second Temple period. What was it like going into exile for 70 years and then coming back? Nobody thought they would be able to. Would they think that they could come back? Did any other nation ever come back after the Babylonians exiled them? Not that I know of. Well, we'll talk about it in a second, right? But to reestablish a state, right? So kind of unheard of. What were they thinking when they actually came back? So Jeremiah is the prophet of the time. And he says, really, maybe the most important prophecy, most important idea that he states during his career is that he says, listen, Jews, you're going into exile, but you're coming back in 70 years. This land is going to be destroyed. You're going to have to serve the Babylonians for 70 years. But after that, I am going to come back and punish him for what he did and bring you back to this land. And he says this twice in another place in Yirmiyah as well. And so he's saying, go there, and when you're in Babel, build homes, be successful, pray for the country. That's where we learn the law that we should pray for the country that we're in, even if they're not so nice to us, but still we're alive. And be well there, but hold on to your identity because you're going to come back. And so the Jews remember this. They remember what Jeremiah said. And sure enough, it happens. Because Cyrus the Great brings a new empire, the Persian Empire, destroys the entire Babylonian Empire. And if you read the book of Divrei Amim, sounds like the first thing he does, maybe the second thing he does, he writes a decree to the Jews. And so let's just read this quickly. So the second pasuk here, the writer of Chronicles says, the following is the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy. He's quoting here from the curses in the end of the book of Leviticus that says you're going to have to go into exile all the years that you neglected to let the land lie fallow. Now you're going to force it to lie fallow because you're going to have to leave it. And in the first year of Koresh, the king of Persia, when the punishment of that Yirmiyah spoke about, the 70 years, was finished, Heir Adonai et Ruach Melech Paras, God aroused the spirit of Koresh. Sounds like Koresh is a prophet that God's speaking to. In fact, in Yeshayahu, says Koresh, calls Koresh the Mashiach. Right? Calls him the Mashiach. He made this decree, God gave me all of the lands of the earth, and he commanded me to build him, Yudke Vavke, a house in Jerusalem, in Judea. Whoever wishes, let him go and make aliyah. Right? That's so absolutely amazing. So what happens? Do people go?
A few
people go, right? But most people, they have nice apartments near Central Park. And, you know, they're like, well, you know, we'll send money. They do. They say they send money, right? They would be supportive. But actually, very few people go, right? Hard to imagine such a thing. Okay. Right, Megillat Esther is happening. So here's the Persian Empire coming and taking over the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Here's some of the wars. Amazingly, we found some years ago, archaeologists found, and the foundation of a building, the Cyrus Cylinder. Last year we went to see it in the museum. It was here in New York. And this actually is filled in some of the picture, because in the Cyrus Cylinder, this is a similar decree that Cyrus makes, but not to the Jews. It doesn't mention the Jews. It mentions, here's this in the British Museum. It mentions a bunch of, Dr. Sham, you want to read this? Okay. All right. So study cuneiform and come back next week, right? So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but what it actually says is he goes to half a dozen other peoples that he conquered and says, all of you should go back to your lands and you should rebuild your temples and start making sacrifice. So what we learn from here is that while the Bible tells us the story just about the Jews, focusing on us, in fact, Cyrus did the same thing for all the peoles he conquered. Why? Well, first of all, make people happy. You know, come back to the opposite. Instead of conquering them, making them feel degraded, and moving them out of their land, give them their national pride, and then they'll like you, and they'll be happy to pay their taxes. Right? Better way to govern. But second, it's actually more explicit in the last line. he says, and then all the gods that they build temples for and give sacrifices in my name, they will all like me. And I'll have all the gods on my side. In polytheism, it's much easier, right, to be pluralistic. Okay, so this is Cyrus's general charter, and it's kind of like the first charter of international relations, and for this reason, Iran, where it was found, was kind enough to donate a replica to the United Nations to show their generosity of spirit and pluralistic spirit. I mean, it's I kind of sob every time I think about this amazing... Okay. Alright, so this is, if we want to, we said this is the fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy. So if we want to just talk about years a little bit, we know that Cyrus the Great said the Jews can go back in the year 539 BCE. 539. So the temple was actually destroyed in 586. So if you have 70 years, I mean 70 years is not necessarily an exact number, it could just be like, seven is means full amount, right? 7 days of creation, which means after a complete period, right? But if we want to take it a little bit more literally and say 7 years, well, 539 take away 70 leaves us in 600 something. Well, what happened then, right? Where are the 70 years? So actually, this actually makes sense because from the time that the Babylonians took over Israel and made Israel just puppet kings, that happened in 606. Right, Yehoiakim, right? And actually Jeremiah's words, if you remember, said, you will be servants to Babel for 70 years. Not you're going to be in exile for 70 years, right? So actually that works out pretty perfectly. And that seems to be the original sense of what Jeremiah was talking about. From the time that the kings of Judah are under Babylonian rule to the time that Persia comes and destroys them and he gets what's coming to him is about 70 years. But here's the interesting thing. That's only the one interpretation of the 70 years. If you look in the book of Zechariah, we find another interpretation. Zechariah is one of my favorite books. That's why I named my fourth son Zachary. Also, I named him after Z, but I didn't know Z when I... Okay. So, the book of Zechariah is a prophet who's living during the beginning of the Second Temple period. And he's encouraging the people, come on, come back. Let's build together. Let's build the Beit HaMikdash. And he cries out to God and says, God, why haven't you have mercy on Jerusalem and these cities that you have been angry at these 70 years? Well, these 70 years, what year is he talking about? Right? He's living after they already came back. And we actually have a date in Zechariah chapter 7. It says in the fourth year of Darius, which is around the year 516, maybe 518 BCE. This is when they, I think 520 this would be. 520 BCE, this is when they first built the foundations of the Beit HaMikdash. And Zechariah gets a question. You know, now rabbis get questions, but then there were no rabbis yet, so he asks a question, you to the prophet. And the following people, certain officers, sent a message to Zechariah asking a halachic question. We'll see what their question was. Asked the priests and the prophets, Lemor, verse 3, should we continue to cry in the fifth month? What's the fifth month? Av, on Tisha B'Av. So we learn here that they had been fasting, crying on Tisha B'Av during those 70 years. But how about now? Now we're building the Beit HaMikdash. Remember, here's the foundations. It's going to be done in a couple of years. Should we continue to fast? He Nazer, should be like Nazarites and abstain from wine and have other mourning customs like we've been doing these years? It's a good question, right? Think about nowadays. We have the state of Israel, right? We have safety. We have a good economy. Should we continue to mourn?
We have 6 million Jews living there, and they had a few.
Right. Now, almost the majority of Jews are living in Israel. I was, you know, watching the news about Israel yesterday and talking about all the things that happened. In the end, it says, and the Tel Aviv stock market was up. Well, I guess great, right? Everything's going on. People are still going to school, going to work, they're playing, right? Okay, so let's see what Zechariah's answer is. We're good to know. Emor el kol ha'am ha'aretz el ha'kohanim lemor ki samtem b'stafot b'chamishi u'b'shivii v'zeh shivim shana hasom samtuni ani. This said you've been fasting 70 years. Have you been fasting for me? He continues. I'll continue in English. He says, and when you eat and drink, verse 6, who but you does the eating and drinking? Does the eating, and who but you does the drinking? Look, this is the message that the Lord proclaimed through the early prophets. And then he quotes the early prophets and says, execute true justice. Deal loyally and compassionate with one another. Do not defraud the widow, the orphan, the stranger, and the poor. Do not plot evil against one another. Okay, so they walked away and said, did he say yes or no? Right? So I remember in high school, you know, we had I was in Yeshiva Flatbush, and we celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, and it's a big day, but we also learned with other rabbis on the side who said you're not allowed to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, it's during the Omer, it's a morning time, and you're not allowed to dance. And so me and my friend, we were like all confused, we didn't know what to do, it was the day before, like what should we do? So we actually went to synagogue, and we asked the chief rabbi of the Syrian community then, he had an accent, he was from Syria, and so we asked him, can you dance on, we were arguing, I said we should, he said we shouldn't, so we asked him, and so he gave his answer, and then me and my best friend, we walked away, and I said, I told you so, and he said, I told you so. He says, what do you mean? He said it's not a problem. My friend said, no, he said, it's not proper. We couldn't understand the accent. And we never went back to ask him, and now he passed away, so I still don't know what their answer was. But I have to imagine that that's what these messengers walked away. So Zechariah says, well, you think God's fasting when you're fasting? You think God cares if you eat? Does he get full when you eat? Rather, you have to be good and do justice and act ethically. And so, well, what's the answer, right? The answer is? The answer is it doesn't matter. You're asking the wrong question, right? By asking that question, by asking about this technicality of halakha, do I fast, do I not fast, you're missing the point, right? The reason that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in the first place is because you weren't taking care of people, you weren't being nice, you were murdering, you were stealing. If you're continuing to do that, it doesn't help if you're going to fast. And if you change your ways and you're being nice, then it also doesn't matter if you're fasting, right? So don't ask the question in the first place. Okay. But still, what's the answer? So the next chapter, Zechariah says, right, there's going to be there shall yet be old men and women in the squares, each with a staff in his hand, because of his great age, and people dancing and enjoying the land. And the last line he says, the words of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, thus said Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, the fast of the fifth month, Shavuot, Tishah B'Av, and Tisha B'Av, the fast of the seventh month, Tzom Gedaliah, and the fast of the tenth month, Asara B'Tevet, shall become occasions for joy and gladness, happy festivals for the house of Judah, but you must love honesty and integrity. Right? They will become joyous, but it's not because we happen to be building this space, this physical building, that this Beit HaMikdash is not going to change anything. It's only when you change your actions will they become days of rejoicing. Okay, so how about today? Right? What do we do? Are we ready? Are we ready to start celebrating? When do we know that the redemption happened? When do we know that this is what the prophets were talking about? In the beginning of the State of Israel, we talk about Beshit Smichat Gulatenu, so the beginning. So how long does the beginning last? Right? And this is a live debate that's been going on, is still going on right now. But maybe we can quote the Gemara about this. Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. Dr. Sham has been doing some research on this. He helped me with some of the sources. And this asks our very question in a more contemporary sense, to all their days. At least it's later than Zechariah's time. And he says, what is the meaning of the verse that God says these are fast days, but then he calls them days of joy and gladness? Which is it? Is it a fast day or a day of gladness? Second paragraph. So the prophet calls these both days of fasting and days of joy, signifying that when there is peace, they shall be for joy and gladness. But if there is not peace, they shall be fast days. So it depends on the situation in Israel. Is there peace or is there not peace? The Papa adds, what it means is this: when there is peace, these fast days should be for joy and gladness. If there is persecution, they shall be fast days. If there is no persecution and yet no peace in the middle, then those who desire may fast, and those who desire need not fast. Okay. Now, if that is the case, what about the Tisha B'Av? Is that also optional? He says, no, Tisha B'Av is different because many misfortunes happened on that day, and it lists them. So there's a fundamental difference between Tisha B'Av, which is the national day of mourning. Even if things are good, we need one day to commemorate the past. Right? And that's important. And so that remains, even if there is a time of peace. But the other three fasts, those are dependent on what's going on. Is there peace, or is there not? Is there persecution or not? So what about today? How do we judge what's going on today? Yeah?
Would you translate the Gemara, Ratsu Mechanin, when they decided, not up to the individuals, Ratsu?
Okay, good, good.
Not Ratsu when they decided.
Good, so I'll get... Right. Okay, excellent. And so who is the decision up to? The Rishonim talk about this, and the Rishonim already say, well, so now, right now it's not a time of pogrom. Some may say it's a time of peace, and that's talking about in medieval times, right? So certainly today it's not a time of pogroms. Is it a time of peace? Well, considering what's going on, I'm not sure we could say that. In any case, in the 1970s, there was a group of scholar rabbis, Ephraim Elimelech Urbach, Rosh Rosenthal, some of the great scholars, Talmud scholars of those days, people I read every day, that hadn't known about this. They actually got together and they made a small movement, Tenuali Hadut Shel HaTorah, and they got together in someone's house on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, and they prayed regular prayer without any of the fast day Tachanunim. And they continued to do this for about 10 years. But then it never caught on, right? And so no one else followed. And so I think this is a good question today. And I think really, if we look at the Gemara, it would be a nice thing if we had a national consensus, if the Rabbanut and if we got together and decided this. I wouldn't recommend doing this on our own, because I think that would only cause more conflict. And the whole conflict was happening because of Sinat Chinam and controversy in the first place. And so you wouldn't want to do something that's only going to cause more controversy, but I think it's something that we can talk about and have in mind, and maybe we can at some point come to a general consensus. I mean, yeah.
I think we have to point out that when they say persecution, the rabbis who explain persecution against performing your religious duties. It doesn't become us.
Right. No, it's not persecution, but it might not be a time of peace.
Right.
Okay. Okay, good. So, that's the Gemara. This is where it was really a side point, because if we get back to what Zechariah is saying, he's saying, just that you've been fasting these 70 years, I wanted to add that, you know, the very question, do we have to fast today, do we have to fast, is really making the same mistake that the questioners of Zechariah asked, right? It really doesn't matter technically whether we fast or not, as long as we're doing, as we're acting justly. And so we wouldn't want to make the fast into a matter of controversy. Okay. But in any case, Zechariah says, this that you've been fasting these 70 years. And he's writing in the year 516 about when they're rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. And he says, these 70 years, so if you go back from there, count 70 years, you get to 586, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in the first place. Right? So this is interesting, because he has a second count. It says the 70 years is from the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash to the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. Now, why does he have a different count than the Book of Chronicles and then that Ezra had? Right?
Maybe because he's talking about the fasting, which started at the destruction.
Well, yeah, I don't know when the fasting started, right? But still he's saying 70 years, instead of Jeremiah, 70 years. And so perhaps it's because, well, when Cyrus the Great said this thing, everybody says, Mashiach, this is great, this is happening, but then they saw what actually happened. Only a few people came back, the Samaritans gave them a hard time, they couldn't rebuild, economy was nothing, people all assimilated, and they said, this doesn't feel like the Geulah here, right? So this must not be it. So Zechariah comes and says, now I'll give you a second interpretation. Now it's going to happen, right? This is going to be the great, this is going to be the great one. However, even now, things weren't so great. It says that even when they built the Beit HaMikdash, the young people were joyous, but the older people who remembered the glory of the first HaMikdash, they were crying at the same time, right? And still, there weren't many people there, and the situation was very difficult for them. So it still didn't quite feel like the redemption happened. And so we actually have a third interpretation, which is in the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 9, it's very interesting. It's good for historians, because Daniel says, I sat down one day and opened the books. It opened the history books, the books of the prophets, because he wanted to figure out the history and calculate when is the 70 years that Jeremiah talked about. And now, why does he have to ask again? We already have two answers to the end, right? So he says, no, those answers aren't good. This, that didn't feel like the redemption either. And so he prays and prays, and you know this chapter by heart, even if you never read it inside, because all of our Tachanonim come straight out of this chapter. And finally, at the end, the angel Gabriel comes to him and says, I've come to give you the answer. The answer is that when Jeremiah said 70, he didn't mean 70 years, he meant 70 weeks. Now, 70 weeks, that's even short, it's only like a year and a half, right? But no, not weeks of days, 70 weeks of years, 70 Shemitot, which is 490 years. This completely changes. What happens, what's going to happen in 490 years from the time of Jeremiah? Well, it turns up to be about the time of the Hashmonaim, right? And in fact, Daniel describes Alexander the Great and everything that happens there. And so Daniel is saying, no, we're not fully redeemed until we have our own state. We're not under the Persians. We're not under the Hellenistic empires, but we're on their own, and we can do and practice the way we wish and live the way we wish. That is the fulfillment, right? So you see that even in the Beit HaMikdash period, when you even had prophets there at the beginning, it's still difficult to calculate, when do we call this the redemption? When can we now be joyous? How long do we have to keep on mourning and remembering the past? And this is not an easy question, because everything's happened in stages, and what things are you going to focus on? So I think it's so fascinating, because this is not a new problem that we deal with today of how do we assess the new state of Israel and what's going to be the ramifications. I think a lot of the communities are afraid. This is, we've gone along well in diaspora for 2000. We know how to do this. Now you're giving me something new, right? And you go to someone in business, hey, I have a new way, I have a new program, you can use this. Even if it's better, it's just that change, well, you don't know what's going to happen. And so it brings a lot of questions and a lot of anxiety having this new state of affairs and coming to terms with it and learning how to succeed with the new state is something that is difficult and will take many generations until we fully realize the potential. Okay, so that was the second topic of mourning and thinking about redemption. And we should think about both today and some of the prayers that we say at Tisha B'Av. Some of the prayers talk about Jerusalem that is destroyed and empty and has nobody living there. And right, I don't think we can say those same words anymore. I mean, it's going to be insulting to all the people living there. Will you? Nobody, right? But rather appreciate, right, that there is a fundamental change, even as we also mourn the pain and suffering that has happened. Okay, so now for the third topic, which is the Gemara that I quoted last time, says the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. And we know so much about this because we have real historical sources, not only from the Gemara, but also Josephus, and now the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of the first scrolls we found is called The War of the Sons of Light Against the Sons of Darkness. It's just absolutely amazing to read the scroll, because this little group of 200-300 people says, we are the sons of light. And the sons of darkness are not just the Romans, but all the other Jews, right? And soon enough, any day now, Mashiach will come, and we're going to have this war. They have all battle plans. They describe what they're going to put on their flags and on their shields, and they have all their exact plans ready. They're going to go and destroy all the other Jews and retake the Beit HaMikdash and do things their way. So this is really hatred. I mean, I get some hope when I read that text, because as much as we're fighting today, we don't have anything nearly as bad as that, right? I don't know. Does anybody have, any of these groups have, secret battle plans to kill everybody else? I don't think anybody does. So we do still have terrible infighting. We had our prime minister killed by another Jew. So still serious fighting. But I think compared to the second Beit HaMikdash, we're pretty much unified. Yeah.
Thought that the language
could be
giving us a taste
of what we're talking about. Based on hatred, sinat chinam is today's snark. Sinat chinam,
which is basically a nasty way of looking at people.
Okay. Right. Good. So we know that the Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, all these groups fighting about religious matters, political matters, so I want to summarize the story that the Gemara says about why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed. Many aspects of the story are historical, some aspects are not historical. Did I say something wrong? Okay, they're all historical. No. We know that they're not historical because the Gemara itself has different versions of it in different places, and so it takes some work. But I think we should read these stories about more about what the rabbis are saying about the way they interpret the history that they know of. And so the Gemara says, why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. And you know the famous story, this is not an actual ancient mosaic of the scene, but this is a modern guy who made this mosaic, but I think it's really nice, right? So here you have the host of the party in the middle, and he wanted to invite Kamsa, but instead he wrote the wrong name on the invitation, invited Bar Kamsa, and he tells him, you have to leave my party, and Bar Kamsa says, please don't embarrass me, I'll pay for my meal, I'll pay for the whole thing, just don't embarrass me. And the host says, no, you have to leave, right? And so you think that the point of the story is that the host is such a bad guy, but actually the end of the story says, and the rabbis were sitting there, see them here, right? They're sitting at the head of the table and they didn't do anything, right? And so really it's pointing the finger at them for not standing up and saying, hey, this is not the way we act. And because of that, Bar Kamsa then went to the Roman emperor and accused the Jews of rebelling. Right? So this is the first story of this baseless hatred, just because your name is not this, your name is something else. Okay, something like this just happened on Saturday, but I can't tell you the details. Someone was invited to some place, and he was uninvited by some people in that place. So this is still going on. Okay, so here's the continuation of the story. Bar Kamsa said, since the rabbis are sitting there and they didn't stop him, this shows that the rabbis agreed. And they also, right, they were okay with kicking me out. I'm going to go inform against them, against the government. So he goes to the emperor and says, the Jews are rebelling against you. The emperor says, how do I know this is true? He says, send them an offering and see whether they will offer it on the altar. This was commonly done. Every year the emperor would send a sacrifice to be done on, burnt on the Beit HaMikdash, and it was perfectly fine. So he sent them a fine calf. While he was on the way, Bar Kamsa made a blemish in his lip or its eye, a place that if we took it to a pagan temple, they would say it's okay, so the Romans think it, but according to Jewish law, this is a blemished animal and cannot be sacrificed. So the rabbis were inclined to offer it in order not to offend the government. But there was a rabbi there named Zechariah ben Avkulas, and said to them, people will say that blemished animals are offered on the altar. Right? We can't offer because you'll start a new halakha. People will think that you can do this, and it has a blemish like this, you're allowed to sacrifice, you're going to start a precedent. He says, okay, we can't do that. So I know, one rabbi says, let's kill Bar Kamsa. I mean, why not? He's a traitor. He's going to cause destruction, bring destruction on the Jewish people. It's perfectly okay to kill him, so he shouldn't go back and inform against them. But the same Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulas said, should they say one who makes a blemish on consecrated animals is to be put to death? Right? Then you're going to make a bad precedent and think people are going to think this. And instead, they did not kill Bar Kamsa, and they did not sacrifice the animal, and the emperor took this as a sign that the Jews are in fact rebelling, and that started the war.
Should they have done?
What should they have done?
Yeah.
They should have sacrificed it, right? And the Rabbi Yochanan, who comes a couple of generations later, says, because of anbatnuto, which literally means his humility, but maybe it means like meekness, of the Zechariah ben Atkulas, destroyed, because of that, our house has been destroyed, our temple burnt, and we ourselves exiled from the land. In other words, because he was looking at some technicality of some detail of ritual, and not looking at the bigger picture, hey, this is going to destroy the land, that's why it was destroyed. In other words, the rabbis were passive. Right? Passive now twice. In the meal, and again, at this time, they were sitting there, and they let this fanatic have the day. Right? There's always going to be a couple of fanatics, but the important thing is to have strong leadership that makes sure there's some fanatics stay on the side and don't take up the main position. Right? And that's what destroyed it. And this is the rabbis saying this story. Right? It's the most amazing part. Rabbis are being self-critical about the way they had acted or not acted during that time. Zechariah ben Abkulas, we have a similar name mentioned by Josephus. Zechariah also, and he's not mentioned, Josephus is not mentioned as a rabbi, but rather as a priest who was one of the leaders of the rebellion, was a revolutionary. So at this time, most of the people actually wanted to make peace. Most of the Kohanim wanted to make peace. The Kohen Gadol wanted to make peace with the Romans. What was it like to live under the Romans? Not so bad, really. The Romans allowed the Jews to practice whatever they wanted. They had actually respect for the Jewish traditions. They liked old traditions. And so they allowed the Jews to do their thing. And as long as they paid their taxes. And so things weren't really so bad, right? But others said, no, we have to have independence, and we're going to fight against the Romans. Probably because of messianic fervor, and they thought that they could win. The Rambam, in his letter of astrology, very famous letter, he says, why did the rabbis lose the war? Why did the Jews lose the war to the Romans? Because they depended on astrology that promised that they would win, rather than studying tactics of war. If they studied tactics of war, then maybe they would have had a good plan and won, or realized that they have no plan and wouldn't have fought in the first place. Right? Okay. So that's the second story. Third story, this is right after, one after the other. So the emperor sent Vespasian against them, and he came and besieged Jerusalem for 3 years. There were three rich men there. These men had enough food to feed them for 21 years. So now they're in a besiege. And a siege is a waiting game. Who can last the longest, right? And they had enough food for 21 years. The Romans aren't going to stick around for 21 years. They have more important things to do. So they could have won. They were among us, those rebels, right? These few terrorists, Jewish terrorists. The rabbi said to them, let us go out and make peace with them. The rabbis wanted to make peace. The rebels said, would not let them out. The rebels stood at the door, wouldn't let the rabbis go out to make peace. The rebels said to the rabbis, let us go make war. The rabbis said, it will not succeed. So the rebels arose and burnt the provisions of wheat and barley, and there was famine. The Jews themselves burnt their own silos so that there would be so much suffering and famine, and that would force the Jews to go out and actually fight. This is the saddest part of the story. And I mean, unlike the first two stories that are about certain individuals and we can't verify their historicity, this actually, Josephus and Tacitus give the same reports that vast quantities of grain in Jerusalem were burned by the Jews. Right? So sad. This is the infighting that the Gemara is also talking about. This is not absolutely baseless. I mean, this is no reason for it. Okay, so I think from here we can see some of the sense of the a statement about really leadership and dealing with the problems of the time. And I think we have the same questions today as we think of problems that Israel is dealing with, whether it be conversion of Russians whose fathers are Jewish but not their mothers. And during the Second Temple period also they had to deal with these questions of identity, of half marriages, I think because of the scrupulousness of certain halachot, Right? Some rabbis are saying we can't do anything, we can't deal with this, we can't do anything about it. Whereas most rabbis, most Orthodox rabbis, most people look at the source and say this is not such a difficult one to solve, and look for the greater good of the state. Right? We can have this the population that are half Jews and not Jews. They're going
to
integrate. Yeah, that's another way of dealing with it. But here's right. But this is an alternative, right? And what's going on? And the tremendous hatred. I mean, if we think, I think the biggest challenge of Israel to the outside is these wars and the ethics of how to deal with those who want to destroy us from the outside. But on the inside, the internal fighting between Charedim and Chilonim, the absolute hatred and not understanding where the other one's coming from, and not fighting in the army. I mean, where is the rabbinic leadership? Here. And this is so many things that we need to take stands on. And just as the Palestinians have their minority of rebels, but have taken over the majority, we also have our minority of terrorists. But I think we've done a good job of sidelining and make sure that they don't represent what we believe. And so I think the Gemara is telling us something for today, that we need our own strong leadership, both by the rabbis and by the lay people who are backing them up. So if we take all these ideas together, questions about war and ethics towards external, questions about how do we deal with this new reality? Should we mourn? To what extent should we be celebrating? And the questions of leadership that we'll take to bring us forward into the new generation. I think these are all things that are on our minds now during these 3 weeks, and especially as we watch the events and unfold. And I just always keep in mind this verse from Zechariah, that they will be days of joy and gladness. But the end is the most important. But you must love honesty and peace. Ultimately, right? These are the values that will bring us through this crisis. So, thank everybody so much for joining us. We have 2 minutes. If any comments or questions.
It's a comment. I've become aware recently because I'm dating someone from Toronto. His sister made Aliyah. They live in Deshen. But you were commenting about, I guess, conflict within the Jewish world. And just a comment, the one thing I've become aware of is we have ultra-Orthodoxy now. So I understand that Houston Beth-Shemesh is putting all kinds of pressure on the modern Orthodoxy. And I wanted to comment because I see this as a potential problem for Israel. You need to deal with that.
Right, and it's a problem both for their leaders and for the opposite extreme to help bring them around. I mean, I think many Chilonim, especially now, kind of coming around, they want to have some Jewish identity because this Zionist dream is not going to keep them going for forever. But you need something that is authentic and is the basis of the Zionist dream in the first place. And so I think the Rabbanut, and they have an opportunity to bring them in. Really, more of the Sephardic tradition is always to have one community, and people are on different levels, but you keep everybody together, rather than the relatively new reform, which says En Achariut Hamalenu, we're not responsible for those who are less religious than us, right? And so, I don't know why, but the kind of the vision of Rabbi Uziel, one of my heroes, isn't very loud nowadays. But I think this is one of our challenges that we can bring and we can help. George.
My concern today is more the modern methods of producing Hasbara and the information go out are essentially visceral, and they go directly to the emotions and not to the brain. It's not clear that this was the way this was done before, because there were very relatively few witnesses, and it was passed on, and there were perhaps books and discussion of it. Much of there had been through the end of the 19th century. But with the notion of what we have now, and the immediacy of what comes, without being filtered, without being thought through,
right,
the rest, and you yourself said, Twitter and the rest of this,
yeah,
the same thing. especially the, we haven't found a way to mention this fact.
Right.
And that even religion is so new that we haven't found a way to come to
right.
this.
Right.
Just all the emotions.
Absolutely. I think that technology is a double-edged sword. It can spread hate very quickly, but it can also spread enlightenment and bring ideas to places where there is no free press, and bring more thoughtfulness also very quickly. So it's just how you deal. A good friend of mine is actually running a website explaining Judaism in Arabic. Now, maybe not the entire Arabic world will read it, but some will read it and say, "Oh, now you know I understand a little bit more about what this is about." Right? So there's wonderful opportunities, and I'm hopeful we got through. Well, we got through so many difficulties in the past, but we'll get through this today as well. And God should send safety and security to all of our soldiers and all those that are involved in this conflict. Amen. Thank you all. Good night.
I don't know if you have a telephone here, I could show it to you.